Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Because you never think the last time is the last time. You think there'll be more. You think you have forever, but you don't.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis, and we are continuing to celebrate perfect episodes of television.
Vanity Fair recently made a list of 25 perfect episodes of the past 25 years, and each of us have brought our favorite to the podcast today to break down why our pick gets our seal of approval.
Last week, we looked at comedies. This time, we are all about the drama. Okay, so, Richard, I want to put you on the spot to start. We have an episode of The Sopranos on the list that we made.
It's not the one that you picked.
Which is not the one that you picked. So, Richard, Pine Barrens, I feel like, is often cited as the best episode of The Sopranos. You went in a different direction. Yeah. Explain yourself.
I did. I went with The Sopranos season 6, later season episode 11, Cold Stones, which was written by Diane Frolov, Andrew Schneider, and David Chase, and directed by Tim Van Patten. It originally aired on May 21st, 2006.
Oh, Jesus, you can't even talk to her.
Are you fucking kidding me? You should be kissing her feet, because when you were growing up, if it wasn't for her, I would have knocked all your baby teeth out with one shot.
All right, here's a recap of Cold Stones. Tony is disappointed his son AJ lacks ambition and isn't, quote, a real man.
I couldn't even hit him if I wanted to. He's so fucking little. It's Carmela's side of the family. They're small people. Her father, you could knock him over with a fucking feather.
But I have to point out, what you resent Carmela doing for AJ, protecting him from his father, is the very thing you had often wished your mother had done for you.
Carmela is off to Paris and in a dream sees Adriana walking her dog.
Cosette. Your friend, someone needs to tell her she's dead.
After the revelation that Vito is gay, Phil, who is acting boss for the Lupertazzi family, wants him dead.
Father told me Vito doesn't renounce that lifestyle. He's damned.
I know.
What?
I know.
Vito's murder creates complications for Tony.
You know what this is, right? It's not about Vito, it's about me. Phil's saying he can do whatever the fuck he wants, including kill a captain in my own family, and I can't do a fucking thing about it.
And some crude jokes about Vito by Phil's boy Fat Dom leads to an impulsive murder by Sal and Carlo.
Tom, you don't want to come in here. Get back in your car, go for a ride.
What?
I picked this because I am a fan, unlike a lot of Sopranos fans. I love all of Sopranos. But I like the later seasons. I like when the show started to get more metaphysical and questioning about existence beyond. I mean, obviously, the show is always metaphorical, allegorical. It wasn't really about the mob. Mm-hmm. But I think this is when
it's about ducks.
Right, exactly. Yes, exactly. It's ducks and therapy. Mm. I think this is where the show Cold Stones, when David Chase and his writers really sort of force the audience into these bigger, more profound questions of being in the form of, yes, Carmela going to Paris, which contains some of my favorite lines of the whole series ever. But also the Vito storyline, which, you know, is... There's a lot of sad stories on Sopranos, you know, Adriana, mm-hmm. many other people. But like Vito's is just so tragic because the last time we saw him, really, he had kind of found another life, you know, away from this, you know, and now he's sucked back into it. And
his boyfriend seemed nice.
Yeah, he did.
His boyfriend seemed nice.
Was it in New Hampshire? Is that
where
they
were? Yeah, it's in New Hampshire. Yeah. And the end of the... Is it, I forget what episode it is, where he first goes away. He's at some like little antique store and the proprietor, he picks out a vase and he's like, oh, that's like the antique, the owner says, that's like the best thing in the store. You're a natural. And that's the last line of that episode. And you're like, oh, maybe he's okay. Yeah, he's not okay.
He's not okay.
And I think that the way that this episode balances the horrible, violent finality of Vito's storyline with Carmela having this kind of awakening, but then she kind of brings herself back down to earth mm-hmm. and realizes that like she can't fully forsake everything that has essentially brought her to Paris.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's almost as tragic.
She's back to folding laundry by the end of the episode.
Right. Yeah, and also Rosie April saying, Ma, Paris is one for the ages. What did you guys think of this episode?
So I'm going to come out and say that I've never finished all of The Sopranos. I started
that's
it.
Fine.
I got through three
I'm
seasons.
I'm so sorry, Chris, you're fired.
that's a wrap for me. I've watched three seasons in the pandemic and then life happened again. And I loved it. I will quote Olivia Rodrigo. I don't always have time to watch an hour 15 episode of television. She just said that in Rolling Stone. But I do remember as a kid watching my parents watch the New Hampshire episode. Like mm-hmm. I came in and I saw the license plate Live Free or Die. And I remember like the Vito from then, but I never knew what happened to him because I never finished it. So this was a very interesting episode. Just personally being like, oh my God, I did not know this is what happened to this character that was sort of bouncing around in my mind from like 20 years ago. But I thought it was really fantastic. As someone who did not watch the season or didn't really know exactly what's happening.
Out of context. How
out of context,
feel?
It does still work. It's a little bit like, I think I missed some of like the fill of it all. Like why it was like, okay, they hate him because he's gay. I feel like there is another layer beyond that that I might not know because of, you know, not knowing the show, but I could definitely follow. I definitely got the broad strokes.
Well, Vito was married to Phil's niece.
Okay.
So I think, right?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's why he's particularly, because he seemed particularly upset, particularly mad, and going behind Tony's back and, you know, whacking him. But I loved going from, and I'm a Jersey native, Jersey strong, but going from the harsh, sort of disgusting vistas of New Jersey and then cutting to Carmela in Paris, and sort of that juxtaposition was so visceral to me, and so like the two worlds, I thought it was so fantastic, and I loved spending time with Carmela there and her sort of seeing the beauty of Paris and France and getting away from New Jersey, but then ultimately being pulled back. And I really liked the Tony AJ storyline. And I think
that
the toxic
opening,
masculine...
Ugh. That opening is so funny.
It's so good.
Like, oh, yeah.
I went to Blockbuster today to rent Cinderella Man, and guess what?
Is it still a classic?
I found out that our son, the liar, had been fired 3 weeks ago.
From Blockbuster? How the fuck do you do that? They got Rhesus Monkeys working as managers over there.
The Sopranos, obviously, credit for like being, gets a lot of credit for being the best drama that TV has ever made. It's also just such a funny
so
show.
So funny. Fired from Blockbuster.
Fired from Blockbuster Video.
Yeah, I mean, Tony.
Is she drinking beer? Is she there drinking champagne with you in her wheelchair?
Yeah.
I think that juxtaposition, Chris, is when there's a shot of Paris, I think it's maybe Carm looking at the Seine. And then it cuts right to the Bada Bing sign and Silvio saying, wash that shit off her tits. And you're just like, oh, God.
Oh, God. Yes.
Like, you know, I think that that's sort of high, low. And that I think that obviously Edie Falco did amazing award-winning work on this show. And I think this episode, you really see why, you know, she really understands that Carmela wants to be out of that seediness, but kind of doesn't at the same time and fancies herself sort of an intellectual. And Ro kind of gets annoyed with her on the trip, being like, can't we just enjoy ourselves? Why do you got to bring up all this death and all this, you know, stuff? Mm-hmm. But also, I think that Carmela is genuinely having profound moments in Paris. Like her saying, who could have built this? And standing in the ruins and saying, all those lives, it's so sad. You know, like I relate to that travel experience. I don't have mobster husband back home, I don't
you
think.
Don't?
But like, I don't know. I think when the show leaves its environment in whatever way, the stifling, awful, scariness of where we spend all our time on this show really becomes that much clearer.
Yeah.
And I think this episode probably does it better than any of the other ones.
Yeah, and shows how complicated she is. As, yeah. Because I think that, like, you know, a lesser show, she's just like this victim, right? But she's kind of choosing to victimize herself. And she's also, you know, she's very aware of, like, the material comforts that she gets from Tony's line of work. Like, there's a lot going on. But yeah, this is an episode that I hadn't thought about since I watched The Sopranos, and I haven't rewatched it, but this made me want to, just because it's so like rich. There's so much in there. Like, all of the little details are so good. The Fur Elise ringtone really like ringing out after that really, really brutal murder scene. The Adriana dream, like when she just appears.
By Adriana and
Cosette.
Like, no, that just like really got me. It's a show. It's another show that really rewards deep attention, obviously. And yeah, and there is more to see in it each time you go back because it's just so layered.
There's a great, I don't know if you got that far in the show, Chris, but there, Tony, sorry, spoiler, Tony gets Tony gets shot by his cousin Junior, and there's a whole episode where he's basically in a coma and he's having this weird coma dream, and it gets very abstract, but he keeps seeing this light in the distance, kind of a lighthouse spinning. And in this episode, Cold Stones, there's a scene where Carmela looks up at the Paris sky and it's the Eiffel Tower doing its spinning light, like calling back to that episode. They're kind of bound in this existential wrestling. It's exactly that kind of like detail and poeticism that I think, you know, when this episode aired, I think a lot of fans who always liked The Sopranos just for shoot, shoot, bang, bang, whatever, were like, what is this? I think most fans of The Sopranos appreciated all of it, the show's depth. But like, I have read this pointed out as one of the most boring episodes of the show ever, because it's about a lady and a gay guy, I guess. But I think it's one of the most fascinating. And I also think it sets the tone for how the show ended. The show ended not in any sort of satisfactory, well, you know, traditionally satisfactory way.
Not in like a big climactic, shootout.
It's a big existential question mark.
Yeah.
And I think this is where David Chase started kind of laying the groundwork for that.
And I don't know. I feel like the dream heavy episodes can be a little too opaque for me. But in this, I think that is balanced. Like the poeticism is balanced nicely with more like just like on the ground story development. And that's a nice balance.
Yeah,
I think it's also the first time, if I'm remembering correctly, that we've really seen Carmela grapple with the fact that she knows that Adriana didn't just like move away.
Yeah.
Like she know, like one day she's there and then she's never seen again. Like Carmela doesn't think
she's in long-term parking. Right.
Right. Like I think that Carmela having to come to some sort of conclusion about herself. And of course what it is for the rest of the season, kind of, she like, kind of goes back to the family.
Does she know how Rose's son died?
Well, that's the other thing.
That's the other question.
Well, she brought that up at dinner, right?
So do you know who killed Rose's son?
I don't know. I remember
Vito.
Rose's son.
Vito did.
Oh, Vito killed Rose's son. So I remember Rose's son getting
murdered. So much intertwining.
Okay. And
you
Vito
feel for these
Rose's
people,
son.
But then you're like, wait a second, Vito killed that kid.
Yeah.
Like, he's not a good guy either. Roe is probably somewhat blameless, I guess, because her mobster husband's been dead for a long time. And, you know, but yeah, it's a complicated, dark episode that I laugh at, like you said, you know, the Tony, evil guy, but very funny.
And James Gandolfini is so good.
He is really like,
good.
You can see why, like, it's in why it's on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
Especially when like everyone who worked with him is like, he wasn't like that at all.
Yes, which you could also read about in a very great story that we published on VanityFair.com earlier this year.
Yeah. I love that. Wait, I have a question before we move on, because this definitely made me be like, okay, I have to go back and restart and finish the whole entire thing because it's so, so good. I didn't get the button with the thin club, the photo of Vito, the very end of the episode. Was that just like supposed to be like humanizing? And like,
he had this accomplishment once. He had a little bit of like, I think this episode is almost people imagining what their life could be if they weren't part of this.
Yes.
Vito has had that earlier.
Yes.
Because Vito was never a terribly big character. He just kind of came up a few times. And Carmela obviously is going on this like trip of the mind. Like, and I think it's just supposed to be like, oh, here's this like,
He had dreams.
Humanity once. Humanity, mm-hmm. That is now completely gone from the earth.
Yes, yeah. And he's gone. Cheery. And he had dreams. It's really good. Wow.
Yeah, and the weight he lost. Weight. Right? I don't know.
The soul. So, I'm not James Chase. 21 grams. Yeah. 7 pounds.
Still Watching by Vanity Fair. We'll be back in a moment, and we will talk about two more perfect episodes of TV drama.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, so I love prestige TV and I celebrate prestige TV,
but I decided
to go in a starkly different direction, and I picked an episode of the one and only Grey's Anatomy. I picked It's the End of the World. It was season 2, episode 16, the first of a two-parter episode. The original air date was February 5th, 2006. It was written by Shonda Rhimes and it was directed by Peter Horton.
What's going on?
Bomb in a body cavity.
Man, all I got is Billy's husband's open brain.
All right, here is the synopsis. Intern Meredith Grey struggles to get out of bed as she has the impending sense that she's going to die today.
I have a feeling.
I get those.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And?
If you wait long enough, it passes.
A quiet day at Seattle Grace Hospital is upended when a patient arrives with an unexploded bazooka rocket in his chest, and a paramedic, played by Christina Ricci, is holding it.
What? What's wrong?
Hannah, I don't want you to move. Not your hand, not your body, not an inch.
Okay.
Meanwhile, Dr. Bailey goes into labor, and her husband gets into a car accident racing to the delivery, and McDreamy has to operate on him.
What do we tell Bailey?
Nothing. Let's just wait till I get in there and see how bad the damage is. I have something concrete to tell her.
Yeah, no, he's upsetting her until we know.
As the hospital gets evacuated, paramedic Ricci gets increasingly nervous and, in a moment of panic, pulls her hand out of his chest.
It has to come out.
No, you keep it there. Just a little while longer. Hannah.
I have to.
Really? He's...
It ends on a tense cliffhanger with Meredith's hand now inside the patient. I know Grey's Anatomy gets a lot of flack, but there's a reason that it is the longest running TV drama of all time. And I think this episode perfectly encapsulates everything that is good about Grey's Anatomy and every aspect of why people were so obsessed with it.
I cannot believe this was season 2 and
season
it was already
two.
This bonkers.
Okay, and before I get into just why it was good on like a, you know, textual and acting level, do you know how many people watched this episode? It aired after the Super Bowl. So this is how big the show was.
Oh, Jesus, really?
It aired right after the Super Bowl. Guess how many people?
I know the answer.
Oh, well, you can't
because
guess.
Because I read it. And then my mouth dropped open.
Yeah.
But Richard.
25 million people.
38.1 million people. Can you imagine?
That's a lot of people. That's like eight. That's how many times the size of New York? Is that like five? Like, that's crazy.
That's crazy. And just thinking in the 2023 landscape of like, we're like, oh my God, a show got 2 million viewers. That's amazing. Like,
yeah.
It's
like Mad Men barely cracked a million a week.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Just to think about like it being, you know, part of the monoculture, part of the zeitgeist. Everyone was sitting on their couch after watching the Super Bowl.
Looking at Christina Ricci holding a man's open abdomen.
Huge for Christina Ricci.
Huge. Yeah. She's so good. But literally watching Christina Ricci holding a live bazooka that could explode at any moment in a man's abdomen. And we were all locked in and we were all together on that journey and we were all in lockstep. I just think I remember watching it as a kid and being like, my mind being blown because Grey's Anatomy, it's a soap opera. It's soapy. It's absurd. It's a medical drama that the surgeries and the illnesses get increasingly insane. I mean, this is only sort of like skating
the tip of the iceberg, right. Tip of the iceberg in that way
for where this show is going to go. But I think it does it so well in this episode. And speaking of other episodes, in terms of the layers, everyone, we've got Meredith and McDreamy. He just left her. Derek just left her for Addison. Addison is going to deliver Bailey's baby. Bailey's husband gets into a car accident and he's not picking up his phone. And George is with Bailey. And then Izzy and Alex. There are so many sticks. And then Christina and Burke, and they're all in the OR and they all could blow up at any second.
And we still have time for people having sex.
Sex. Alex and Izzy.
At the hospital.
Yeah. In the midst of everything.
100%. I will say, I watched it again and I was like, I have to watch the second part too. I could not.
I was pretty sure that Meredith Grey didn't blow up in season two, but you know, it's so funny you mentioned the Super Bowl thing. I am now tinfoil hat convinced that's why it opens the way it does with the women in the chef.
1,000%.
You're 1,000% right.
To keep the guys watching. Wait, babe, what is this? Is this what the show is?
It's like three hot chicks in the shower. Right,
That's kind of hack, but that actually makes so much sense.
It's a brilliant move.
Gay guy doing the dream, which is
And then
fun,
it pays off at the end of the second part.
Yes, when Meredith, there's a callback. A much less sexy shower in part two.
But
after Kyle Chandler, spoiler alert, goes kaboom.
Pink mist.
Confess something?
Yes.
This is the first full episode of Grey's Anatomy I've ever seen.
You just hate everything that I've ever picked.
Because last week I had not seen BoJack Horseman.
So watching it, were you like, this is not for me, but I get who it's for?
I will say this. I think you had to be there maybe a little bit. I guess I kind of thought it was a more mopey drama. Like, I thought it was kind of Party of Five. Like, everyone's kind of teary-eyed all the time.
There's a lot of hijinks music.
There's a lot of hijinks music. The T.R. Knight character is like a lot goofier than I thought he was going to be. Chandra Wilson's character's a little goofier. Mm-hmm. I mean, she has a sad thing in this episode. But, you know, I have to say, I know it's problematic. Katherine Heigl just had this, like, radiant charm about her that, like, I can totally see why she became the movie star of the bunch, you know, for a brief spell.
You know?
For a brief moment. But no, I mean, I think it was compelling. It was fun to see Ricci there. Yeah, I guess, like, it was a good example because I knew it was, like, there was voiceover a lot from Meredith, sexual, like, romantic hijinks mixed with medical drama. I guess I was never really sure what the balance was.
Yeah.
And this is probably a more, like, post-Super Bowl. They're, like, up the ante for this one, right? It's not...
But in every way, they up the ante. Like, the stakes of, like, the medical was higher. The sex was... There's probably less sex in a way than normal just because there was less time because
there was
a bomb.
Yeah, but the fact that there is a bomb inside of a man.
Right, right.
Which is such, like, it does kind of contort itself into, like, making this very insane thing seem, like, quasi-plausible. Like, how could this bomb have ended up inside of this man? Like, why would he still be alive? You can't think too hard. You just gotta go along. Like, and then of course he's in an operating room filled with oxygen. Like, such drama layered on drama on drama
on drama on drama. And yet I just love the actors. I mean, Sandra Oh is so good, and she's so good on the show. And this is not nearly really a Sandra Oh episode. I could get into my favorite episodes really of all time. And I would say this is not
my
favorite
episode.
We're
going to do a still watching
spin-off. Yeah.
Yo, do you have like 12 million hours?
Right. 12 years to do it. But I think the performances for what the show is really came through. Sandra Oh, Christina Ricci, Kyle Chandler did a great job. Both Kyle Chandler and Christina Ricci nominated for guest actor in a drama series. Emmys for
deservedly.
And I would say, yeah, so it's not my favorite episode of Grey's Anatomy, but I do think it's a perfect episode of Grey's Anatomy, which is a perfect episode of television in that it really encapsulates the whole series in one sort of 45-minute swoop. And the stakes are never higher. And it was like sort of the peak. This was like the pinnacle, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the show maybe even got bigger in like season 3 or season 4. But to me, this was like,
Yeah, and this is like season two is like when like Katherine Heigl got her Emmy.
Yes.
Like this was like when Grey's Anatomy like was
television.
Yeah.
And interesting of ABC to program a women-led drama after the Super Bowl.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Credit to them. I mean, yeah. Obviously they made them throw in some stuff.
Like,
there better be bombs and boobs. Like, yeah.
Like the most boobs you can have on a network television show.
Right, exactly. And I'm sure like...
It's like a lot of collarbone.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure like Heigl and Sandra Oh and...
Ellen Pompeo.
Ellen Pompeo was also very good.
We're kind of like, okay, we got to do that. Like they're paying us so much. Like, yeah.
And they will for years and years. And Ellen is, and she's really good. And she's a good grounding force.
Are you still a watcher of the show?
No, I made it to like... season 13 or 14.
That's commitment though.
Yeah, but it was sort of like by the end it was in and out, you know, and then for a very special episode, you know, I'll dip back in, but I can't say that I still watch, but I do still respect it. I still have a love in my heart for the series.
It's incredible that it's still going.
Before we move on, I'm curious, like just so I can orient myself. So obviously Addison, played by Kate Walsh, is McDreamy's wife.
Yes.
Is she, but I thought so, but he and Meredith have a thing in the first season and then she comes back, the wife comes back.
Addison and McDreamy are estranged because she cheated on him.
Okay.
So he's fine. So he's actually a good guy.
He's morally okay.
Yes.
And then she comes to Seattle and then the man that she cheated on him with also comes to
McSteamy.
Seattle.
That's Eric Dane.
Yes.
Oh, and McSteamy. Then when does Addison leave to start her private practice?
And then Eric Dane falls in love with Meredith's secret sister.
Right. Lexi, who isn't even here yet.
And Lexi dies a plane crash, right?
Yes. Which Meredith
so
is also
does
on.
McSteamy.
Oh, McSteamy dies in the plane crash?
Yeah, they both die in a plane crash.
The same plane crash,
and they renamed the hospital the Sloan Memorial.
McSteamy Memorial Hospital.
Gray Sloan Memorial Hospital. And that's also where Arizona loses her leg.
Arizona, right?
Because we haven't even gotten to Cali.
We haven't even gotten to Sarah Ramirez. Still watching Stalwart.
Yeah, it's just...
When does McSteamy go and do all those horrible things to those kids in Euphoria?
I do think that they could be in a shared universe.
Okay. Yeah, 100%.
So we've just spoiled all of Grey's Anatomy for you folks. Sorry.
No, that's the first 10 seasons.
There's so much more to go.
There have been 19 seasons since this.
And there's a musical episode too, Richard, that you have to get into.
Oh my God. All right, I have to go immediately and start this journey.
I'll see you in a couple years.
Yeah, I come back with a long gray beard. Yeah.
The things you've seen. Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, it's Hillary's pick for perfect TV drama.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of The Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see... whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Our final pick for perfect TV episode drama comes from Hillary.
Okay, so my pick, I will admit, is a little basic if you're talking about the critical consensus. However, I still think that there's a case to be made for this being like the best episode of TV of like the past 20 years. So we are about to talk about Mad Men, season 4, episode 7, The Suitcase, written by Matthew Weiner, directed by Jennifer Getzinger. It originally aired on September 5th, 2010.
So, where are we on Samsonite?
We'll have something to show you in the morning.
The suspense is killing me.
Here's a recap. Don Draper opts to skip watching the big Muhammad Ali fight so that he can help work late on a Samsonite suitcase campaign. He ropes in Peggy to help.
I gave you more responsibility and you didn't do anything.
That you like. We did work a lot.
I don't care if you work 10 seconds. If you bring me something I like, we're going to do this right now.
Peggy picks work, a.k.a. Don, over the surprise birthday dinner her boyfriend has decided to throw for her.
How the hell are you mad at me?
Because you used my birthday to get in good with a bunch of people who drive me crazy.
Should I have invited Don? You never stand him up.
Don and Peggy's relationship is unpacked as they go on an emotional journey and air their grievances.
That's the way it works. There are no credits on commercials.
But you got the Clio.
It's your job. I give you money, you give me ideas.
And you never say thank you.
That's what the money is for.
Don gets news that another woman he had a complicated relationship with, Anna Draper, has died.
The only person in the world who really knew me.
And by morning, Don creates a Samsonite campaign based off the iconic image of Ali standing over a knocked-out Sonny Liston.
Go home, shower, and come back and give me 10 taglines.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, part of me feels sheepish for, obviously, you have to have Mad Men on a best TV list. When it comes to the best episode of Mad Men, like, you could go, you could try to, like, outthink people. You could try to go for something that's maybe less expected. But, like, going back and looking at the series, like, it is really tough to beat The Suitcase. It's got such great center of Don and Peggy. Their relationship is the, is explored. It's enriched. They ended in a different place where they began it. You learn a lot about both of them and their relations to each other and how their ambitions are similar and, you know, how their background, how their lives are similar and the ways in which they're different. And yeah, I do feel like this is an episode that gets at what made Mad Men so good just in one single hour.
Yeah, I've seen this episode a few times. It's really extraordinary. Peggy has always been, I don't mean this in an oppositional way, the sort of foil to Don on the show. And this episode, four seasons in, like, it really unites them in a way that I think is the show perhaps like revealing its heart the most. But it's still kind of dark and sad and like booze fueled and all that stuff. But I love particularly, I mean, how would you classify this relationship? It's not exactly paternal, filial. It's certainly not romantic. Is it more like brother-sister kind of? Like, I don't know. But like, whatever the dynamic is, I think is so well articulated in this episode. Like, because Don screws all of his other secretaries and that's how Peggy started and he didn't with her. And it's not because she's ugly. It's because he respects her in a way that reveals something negative about Don's character. Peggy is kind of short with her annoying boyfriend. Like, I just think it's such a complicated two-hander character piece that, yeah, it's probably one of the best episodes of the show.
So now it's my turn to admit that I had never seen an episode of Mad Men.
Oh, so wait, then you must have. I feel like
before.
Okay, so then of all of the episodes we picked, I feel like this has the least context. Or did you feel like you got enough of what was going on?
I do feel like I got enough of what was going on. I definitely had some questions and it definitely made me want to watch the series.
So it's the 1960s.
There are these things called ads. Yeah. But no, I really appreciate it. It felt like in many instances, a play, like a two-hander play with Peggy and Don. And I really appreciated that. And I do feel like I totally, if not totally, but I really was fascinated by their dynamic because not knowing what happened at all at the end when they held hands, I was like, is this sexual? Because it didn't really feel sexual and it did feel father-daughter at some points and then maybe brother-sister. I thought there was maybe a sexual aspect at the end too, but that could totally be me just not having the context of their relationship.
Well, if you want to go off and write your fan fiction now, it's a safe space.
Yeah. Peggy and Don. But I really enjoyed it and I honestly was really taken by John Hamm. I know that's probably basic to say, but I do remember everybody like beating the drum, like, where is his Emmy? Where is his Emmy for years?
He didn't win until the very end.
And I was like, oh, now I see why people were so upset that he didn't get his flowers.
This Emmy is actually the one where he submitted this. He was actually beaten by Bomb Squad man Kyle Chandler.
Oh, but not for Bomb Squad,
right,
but for
Friday Night
FNL, which I did love. Well, I loved FNL.
John Hamm has not had a role like this since.
Well, he refuses to do a serious part like this, really.
Yeah. I mean, I know maybe he's tried, I don't know, but like, yeah, he's incredible in this episode. So the context you might be missing is that the woman who died is... So he took someone else's identity and this is that guy's wife or widow, whatever.
Mm-hmm. And she knows what he did.
Yeah.
And like he says to Peggy, she's the only person who truly knew me.
Yes. Yeah, so that's what he meant by that. I read it,
meant it in other ways. Like, and I think that, not in a cynical way, maybe, I don't know if you agree, Hillary, but like Don isn't like auditioning Peggy to be his replacement in that regard.
Yeah.
But he is saying like, I do need someone in my life.
Yeah.
To whom I can confide.
Yeah, and it's more weighted by the fact that Don also, this is a spoiler, but Don also had a brother who died and Don kind of blames himself for that. And so there's like, there's a lot of like weight and there's a lot of history and there's a lot of baggage.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Of The Suitcase.
Of The Suitcase, which I did not know any of that really when I watched it. And yet I was still like very compelled and emotionally moved, particularly by the diner scene. Mm-hmm. I thought was really fantastic.
I'd like to go to Greece.
I'd like to just go on a plane. I've never been.
Is that right?
I've heard about it, obviously. I've seen it in the movies. It's an incredible idea, flying.
I remember on the way to Korea, they told us how many thousand feet in the air we were. There was some other kid there, more of a yokel than me, even. And he screamed, "Man wasn't meant to fly."
Yeah, just like contrasting the two of them, like they do both, like he is now, you know, this like picture of like mid-century success, but like mm-hmm. had very humble beginnings. And, you know, yes. She's now like never even been on a plane. She's just getting started. He's kind of on his like way down because he's just, you know, becoming this alcoholic mess. He recently got divorced, which mm-hmm. you didn't know maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Betty Draper. Mm-hmm. And then them talking about both seeing their fathers die. That was really mm-hmm. sort of poignant. And in the way that Peggy talked about what I assumed was an abortion. And saying that she only thought about it. That wasn't it.
Oh my God, Chris.
I don't know anything.
I'm so excited for you.
Oh my God, I'm going to have to go back and watch
that's
all of
that. That's a very complicated matter.
Complicated.
And you might want to pay attention to the scene with Alison Brie in the bathroom.
Okay, because she says 26 isn't that old.
But Alison Brie in the bathroom, I gotta say, she has like 90 seconds of screen time and
she's
just like
incredible.
Is so good. This was when she was on Community and Mad Men at the very same time, like literally running between the two sets.
That's fantastic.
In order
the range,
to film. My father loves blood sport. It's like such a funny line. And she
I want a raw steak and watch them pound each other.
She's so good.
Yeah. And that's the thing. You're talking about the Cold Stones, the Sopranos of it all. Like, obviously, you know, Matt Weiner wrote on Sopranos, like that mixing of really heavy drama with pointed comedy. I mean, there are some jokes thrown by some of the other ad guys in this that are like really brutal, but like the old secretary says mm-hmm. something really horrible.
Yeah,
her racist line about the fight.
And you're like, oh, I don't know how that would play now. But like there is also genuinely funny stuff, like the joke about the Greek diners and, you know, I don't know. I think the show at its best, and The Suitcase is definitely the show at its best, like is such a beguiling mix of heavy drama, workplace, not exactly comedy, but workplace kind of something approaching comedy. And also this other third thing, this metaphysical murmur that is, you know, like The Sopranos, that this episode stares at head on in mm-hmm. a way that I really appreciate. I mean, Don sees a ghost.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's... I like when the show takes a big swing
like
this.
Yeah, and it also doesn't put too fine a point on, like, the period setting. Like, it finds like a real life event to kind of tack a story onto, mm-hmm. Like, you know, these characters actually would care about this fight between Sonny Liston and Muhammad Ali, like who at that point they would not call Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, they call Cassius Clay, yeah.
And it finds, you know, it decides like this is going to be Peggy's birthday, but it doesn't feel like heavy handed. It doesn't feel shoehorned in. It's not like, it's not like making references for the sake of references. Like it does feel like what this group of people in the 60s would actually be paying attention to and like the things that they would be doing and saying.
And them like Don not liking Cassius Clay. I was like, oh, that feels very typical. That feels like mm-hmm. he'd like Sonny Liston in that.
Yeah, and it says so much about his character too that he's
a showboat. He runs his mouth.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that they made an ad. Mm-hmm. Do they make an ad in every episode?
Not a procedural in that way exactly, but it is nice that it does result.
Is this result in a real ad?
Yeah, in like, an ad that seems very
I think it is. I'm assuming based on, because like Weiner does careful work, I think that mm-hmm. probably what must have been a real ad. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure. I probably should have looked that up. But like...
it definitely feels like it could have benefited.
Yeah, and the way that they arrive at it, and it's not even... Like, it would be, there's an episode earlier in the show called The Carousel where they're kind of, what are they advertising? Like
the photo slide projector thing.
Yeah. And that is Don having this epiphany moment and pitching something that is based on his experience. The Samsonite ad in this is not really informed by what Don and Peggy are going through, but like, you know, there is something about like them fighting through it and whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. Like,
well,
there's
a poignancy to it too, that like he only could have had this idea after the fight was over. Like they didn't have to do an all-nighter. Like, right. He could have just come up with this
the next day.
Right, that's true. That's because of the photograph. Yeah, you know, and it's really good. I watching it this time, the way that John Hamm makes the drinking feel so palpable, like this mm-hmm. mounting, like, and you're like, oh, he's really far gone. And then he has like four more drinks before he throws up. And you're just like, and I love when he's at the diner and he takes a sip of water. And he goes, ugh, I don't want water. It's like, it's
such a good,
he like never hydrates.
Yeah. This episode also really like kind of helps. I mean, the whole series, I guess, is sort of like deconstructing like the idea of Don Draper. And this episode like really, you know, gets at like beneath the like romantic exterior. He's this like a sad alcoholic mess, like with like the vomit on his shirt when he's like lying on the couch.
When he swings and misses that guy's face. That was really funny.
This is the best episode of television to include someone trying to take a shit on Roger Sterling's couch.
That fight was really, I was expecting Don to absolutely whoop his ass, but no, he's too drunk to do it.
There is a man more pathetic than Don. And his name is Duck.
I think that Hillary, you're saying about like Don being this like messy alcoholic saddo, like Peggy is the only person who will even halfway go toward calling him that, you know. I love when she says like, how long are you going to keep this up, like what is this life that you're like, you're a mess. And Don clearly craves someone in his life telling him that, and this was, you know, the woman who died, and maybe Peggy's the new one. That's not really how the show shakes out exactly, but I think anytime like Sopranos, the Mad Men can be a very lonely show. It's about people who are unhappy and sort of atomized from each other. And an episode like this where people come together and they actually talk and they have fun and they bond, but it's not too schmaltzy, it's so well done.
Yeah, it's really, watching it again, it's just like, there is not a show like this anymore. Like, I'm like craving a Mad Men-esque show, something that just has like such a like heavily populated universe of characters with all of these different people, and you know all of their names, and you know all of their stories. Like, you get the impression that like, for whatever his faults are, like Matthew Weiner could tell you like who like Pete's second grade teacher was. Like, it just feels like a very real world, and just like a place that you don't necessarily want to live in because the people are so sad, but like you want to immerse yourself in it. There is not something that scratches a similar itch right now that I can think of.
And Chris, if it's a teaser at all, that racist old secretary,
one
of the most beautiful lines of the whole series is said about her.
That's true.
I think later in the season.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I definitely did not expect that. Okay, but I have to watch.
Did you catch that she's the one who Roger slept with, was talking about sleeping with when they listened to his memoir?
I didn't put that together, but I do now.
Back when
see
she
that.
Was
when she was like young. A young thing, when she was like a pretty,
So if we did like Mad Men Beginnings in like the 1930s, like.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God, maybe they did a prequel series.
Some sort of exec at AMC Plus just keeled over. They're like really running.
You're welcome. So that's it for this episode of Still Watching. Please send us your questions, concerns, anything else. Email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com or find me on the site formerly known as Twitter at Hillabuster with two R's.
And you can find me at Christress.
And I'm at Rylaws. This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Gabe Quiroga. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back soon with a new episode. Looking forward to seeing you then.
I've been watching boxing since I was a little girl. My father loves blood sport.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. They're sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.